Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. In this week's edition of MERS Monday, a former official within what is now the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services concedes that it shouldn't have taken 3 years for the Detroit News to get copies of COVID-era nursing home complaints. Senators Kristen McDonald-Rivett and John DeMoose working across the aisle on a new twist to an older idea. And a former federal tobacco products director questions why Michigan and other states aren't spending more on smoking cessation when tobacco use here is more than 50% above the national average. Now, here's MERS editor Kyle Malin with publisher John Roerink, Samantha Schreiber, and Andrew Miniger.
Thank you, Mark Bayshore. On Friday, the Detroit News published a report on complaints filed against Michigan's nursing homes and their inability to adequately staff their facilities during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic and the horror stories that emerged because of it. Joining us at the beginning of this podcast is Felix Sharp Caballero. He was a state government employee within what is today the Department of Health and Human Services for 13 years as the Director of Behavioral Health Integration. Since then, he's worked as an independent contractor and self-employed consultant for something called the Sharp Impulse Group. He's joining us in studio to talk with the MERS team about this and other subjects. Tell me, first of all, where did your mind go when you took a look at that Detroit news story on the nursing home?
I think that we need to gauge that with a grain of salt, because the nursing home industry, which is regulated by the Department of Health and Human Services, having worked for FIA at the time and the Department of Community Health, so I have some idea of what happens and doesn't happen in that industry. And it had its problems long before COVID existed. What occurred is that COVID essentially exposed the problems that the industry had nationwide, in Florida as well too. And so how we judge Gretchen Whitmer with regard to whatever the numbers were should be judged with a grain of salt, because she doesn't have the ability, and it's a longstanding problem. It didn't just happen during COVID. And she doesn't have the ability to control directly, nor does DeSantis in Florida, to control directly how those practitioners in that industry implemented their programming and protection system for what occurred during COVID, taking into consideration that they had problems before they started. But we certainly need to take a very good look at what occurred in the numbers, because we will see another pandemic type occurrence in this country, and next time we need to be better prepared.
So you think this was more of an industry problem as opposed to a state government problem?
Absolutely.
What's wrong with the nursing home industry, Felix? Why did they struggle so much in taking care of the COVID patients?
The same reason why the juvenile justice system is struggling right now in the state of Michigan, because it's profit-driven and not patient-driven.
How do you fix that? I mean, is that anything state government can do?
Well, state government regulates, absolutely. Okay. Policy, okay. Procedures. The state of Michigan used to have one of the most effective juvenile justice systems in the country, and it was decimated and dismantled in the interest of the private providers. Primarily, one of their facilities was closed in January. And so therein lies the problem, where we focus on profit rather than, you know, what's in the best interest of the whole. Services suffer. And in the industry, both juvenile justice and the home care systems, you know, we have problems, and we have problems that we need to correct. And we can do that through policy and protocol and practice.
So really, this was a wake-up call. When you read that story, it was a wake-up call. It wasn't necessarily a condemnation of Governor Whitmer. It was more a spotlight on what could be done to help fix this part of the healthcare system.
Absolutely, because the reality is that at the beginning of the pandemic, Michigan was one of the states that was on the brink of catastrophe with regard to COVID. Let's remember what was happening in the city of Detroit. And you have to give a lot of credit to Mike Duggan and the effort that the Detroit Health Department and the mayor's office put in place at the State Fair Center, which was a daily process where the mayor was there hands-on every day. And the governor working with the nursing homes, because the nursing homes were in crisis, we were able to quell a serious crisis here in Michigan and actually came out of the pandemic unscathed as compared to many other states who did not take the proactive action.
So all of the federal regulations end May 11. Do you think that there's something that we learned from the pandemic that should be continued in Michigan?
Absolutely. Cooperative collaboration. Because that's what we saw in Michigan during the pandemic. You know, when the shutdown took place in Michigan, we were shut down. And Michiganders took note and notice. We left politics aside and we focused on doing what needed to be done in order to move forward as a state. We cannot not consider and take a look at that. We did what needed to be done here. And I think that, you know, the end result is proof, the proof in the pudding.
Felix, let's talk about the amount of time it took the Detroit News to get these 1,300 pages of documents. 3 years they were doing FOIA requests where the different departments in state government were going back and forth allegedly with the federal government, and there was delay after delay after delay until the Detroit News finally got the documents. I wanted to get your thoughts on that. Was state government trying to wait out the Detroit News so they wouldn't get the documents? And were they doing that because they thought they were going to get an unfavorable story from what they were going to release?
Sometimes journalists get a little too close to the center.
What do you mean by that, too close to the center?
The center of ideology, of their political ideology. And so sometimes we no longer, you know, there used to be a time when you reported the news for what it was. All journalists did, left and right. And we've gotten away from that. We've lost newsrooms and, you know, investigative rooms and news operations. And so it's a struggle for news agencies who intend to do the right, struggle to get through the Freedom of Information Act request, probably struggle to get the information that they needed to have in order to produce a quality product. And, you know, I think we need to check journalism, which has gotten too extreme, but then also, you know, we need to be a little bit more forthright about information requests to the media these days, especially since they're short staffed.
I'm glad you brought that up, Felix, because this is something that has stuck under my craw all weekend. We had this anonymous Twitter bot, or whatever you call these people, these trolls, named Proxy War, who claimed that inside sources confirmed that the Detroit News sat on this story last year. They had plenty of information to publish, but did not. Chad Livingood and Craig Mauger were in the bag for Whitmer. They should go the way of Fox and Bud Light. Give them nothing. So here you're thinking they're a little to the right, and here this guy is saying that they're in the bag for Whitmer, which is completely ridiculous. John, you and I worked with Craig Mauger for 5-6 years here at MERS. I can decisively say that Craig Mauger is not in the bag for anybody politically. I don't even know who he votes for. I have no earthly idea because it never showed in his work. But yet, that's where people's mind go, that we got to start criticizing the reporters because they've got a political agenda when their agenda is just to get out information and get a nice splashy headline and collect information that people are going to read.
Kyle, I want you to repeat one more thing. How many days did they wait?
The Detroit News reported that they waited 3 years before they got this information.
So it was 3 years that that they're waiting for their FOIA request to be filled, right?
Yeah, right.
Let's think about that. 3 years to get information that the public should have access to, that relates to public health, that relates to the care of our elderly.
Shocking. It's really just shocking. Three years.
That's excessive. I mean,
look, we've done federal FOIA requests here before, and I know that they're not fast. I know that it takes them sometimes a year, but really 3 years to basically bounce each other off and throw each other under the bus, it's just too much. It's ridiculous.
What I can say is that knowing Nolan Finley personally, I don't think that anyone at the Detroit News could have sat on that information without Nolan taking action.
Well, I know that's where people's mind goes, but you know, the opinion section of the Detroit News is completely separate from the news gathering operation.
Right, and, right.
And again, we worked with Craig for 6 years. I mean, there's
no... He couldn't sit on a story if he tried.
No, he couldn't sit on a story if he tried, and there is no partisanship. I don't know what Craig's politics are. And the same with Chad Livengood. We've worked as a competitor with Chad for years, and I don't know where his politics are. And he's just trying to get the story. He's just trying to get
pretty
the
straight shooter, in my opinion.
I think it's sometimes it's hard for people who are in politics to understand what drives journalists, because I think when you're in politics for a long time, you have this belief that everybody is kind of driven by the same thing, that they're driven by an ideology or they're driven by a red or a blue flag. And that isn't how journalists are wired. And when you're working for a for-profit company like the Detroit News, it's all about trying to get hit counts. It's trying to get subscriptions. It's about trying to get dollars in the door. It's about trying to get subscribers. It's about trying to get advertisers. And you don't get that by alienating people. So if your goal is to make money, it gives you no benefit to try and alienate half of your potential readership.
Eyeballs are dollars in for-profit journalism. As somebody who did that for nearly 10 years, I can attest that it's a rat race.
I always tell people who ask me, are you more Republican or Democrat? And I always say, as far as I'm concerned, Republican dollars and Democratic dollars spend the same. So we're...
Nope. The checks from the two parties cash the same way.
So we're not really in the business to tick off one over the other. We get no benefit from that. I mean, folks got to look at it from that standpoint. We're in the business, like anybody else who is in the business, of making money. And we don't make money if we alienate half of our potential subscriber base. That makes no sense. From a money-making standpoint.
I couldn't agree with you more. And with the amount of money that we spend in politics these days, you really have to question whether a news entity, the Detroit News or otherwise, would sit on a major story such as the numbers during COVID here in Michigan and how it would affect the election or the governor's race. But it's worthy. I tell you what, it's worthy of further study and discussion to determine why it took 3 years. It should not take 3 years.
Change gears here, Felix. As a Democrat, as you're watching what's going on with the U.S. Senate race, Debbie Stabenow retiring next year, and so Alyssa Slotkin appears to be in a position to be the heir apparent. What's wrong with that?
Problem here, and that is that the Michigan delegation will no longer have an African American representative in its delegation. Many are questioning why wasn't an African American considered for that Senate seat, especially since we lost John Conyers' seat to Tree Tanadar, and Lawrence is retiring. Why not an African American for that seat? And there are some questioning whether or not Hill Harper, who is a Detroit resident, should not challenge the party and run for that seat. And you're starting to see a lot of support cropping up in the elected leadership of the African-American community in the state of Michigan, as well as former elected leadership. Just last night, former Senator Virgil Smith announced publicly on Facebook, Hill Harper, run for the Senate seat. If you do, I will support you. That's an indication of a brewing problem for the party that no one is talking about.
So Virgil said that on Facebook?
On Facebook, my brother. Now, he could have been hacked, but I don't think so.
Well, I know that Virgil has been trying to work with Hill Harper and trying to get him to move in that direction. We've had him on the podcast in a prior edition to talk about that. But I know he was concerned that since it's taken Hill so long to publicly announce that there may be some folks in the African-American community who have just lost patience and have gone ahead and conceded and are now supporting Alyssa Slotkin.
Well, truth be told, it's a difficult position for leadership in state party, elected and otherwise. Very difficult position to find themselves in because, of course, they would want to support Alyssa. But at the same time, Congressman Clyburn of South Carolina saved Joe Biden's candidacy for president of the United States. Mm-hmm. Michigan saved his ability to become president, and the African-American community played a major role in that part. The question is, at which point do you recognize that? And many in the African-American community, many who are committed to Alyssa Stockton, find themselves in a very difficult position trying to navigate those two issues.
Felix, as someone who has been sitting down, you know, in that seat waiting to hear about what the budget is going to look like, just, you know, waiting for a little hint of what your spending ability is going to be, what are your thoughts on the current rumors going around with this current budget making season that, you know, there's a lot of fast movement, not a lot of negotiations, and also the question if Democrats are going to adjourn early this year just so that they don't have to worry about Republicans giving immediate effect?
Now we're talking about the partisanship that exists in government today, which is really out of control. And so everything is gamesmanship on one side or the other. And it's affecting our ability to govern effectively the way that we used to. Remember that when Richard Nixon was impeached, it was it 100% vote, I believe, of both houses of Congress? And, you know, when we moved to impeach a president recently for seditious conspiracy against the country, it was a divided House. And that's where we are, unfortunately. And with $9 billion in the budget, you would think that the Michigan legislature, the government, would come together and find a way to do good for the great state of Michigan with that $9 billion. But unfortunately, in the government process, you know, everybody breaks away to their own corner and tries to secure the funding for their community or for their pet project, whether it be left-leaning or right-leaning. And unfortunately, that's where we are in government. I think that we really need to consider the opportunity that we have here in Michigan. We're the only blue state in the country, and the country is looking to us to lead. I think that we need to do the right thing for the people of Michigan.
The color of your skin don't matter to me. Pow! As long as we can live in harmony.
Why can't we be friends? Why can't we be friends? Why can't we be friends? Why can't we be friends?
Joining us now on the podcast is a pair of senators, Senator Kristen McDonald Rivett, Democrat from Bay City, and Senator John DeMoose, a Republican from Harbor Springs. Thank you both for being on the podcast.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
All right. Well, Senator Rivett, why don't I start with you here? We wanted to have you on to talk about this Buy Michigan legislation that you're introducing that would give Michigan-headquartered companies a chance to counter lower bids from out-of-state businesses as part of the state of Michigan's procurement process. Tell us a little bit about the origins of this bill.
Yeah, so I'm thrilled to be able to work with Senator DeMoose and to bring this Buy Michigan package of bills forward. This isn't the first time we've seen it in the legislature. It's never really made it across the finish line to the governor's desk. But we really believe that it's important that we give Michigan businesses and Michigan workers a leg up. The state spends billions of dollars a year on goods and services. And coming out of the pandemic, coming out of, as we are fighting our way out of inflation, we still have a lot of businesses that don't have both feet on the ground. And I think anything that we can do that will invest Michigan tax dollars right back in Michigan is good for our state. It's good for our economy, and it's good for our workforce. So it's one of the reasons why I prioritized it in bringing it forward, and hopefully having a good solid discussion about it early in the process.
Why was this important to you, Senator DeMoose?
Well, I'll tell you what. I've always believed in buying American at the federal level, and you know, we should be building our businesses here. I'm concerned about things like rebuilding manufacturing here, and you only do that by supporting our manufacturing companies. And same is true across all kinds of industries. So why wouldn't I support this in Michigan? We work for the state of Michigan. We're trying to build a viable economy that sort of turns around the direction of our state that for decades we've been losing people and we've been losing industry, and we're trying to rebuild our state. Why not give Michigan companies another shot? And so when Senator McDonald Rivett came to me about this, I just, one, was very thankful she thought of working with me on this, because I've been wanting to work together with her. I think we're both sort of reasonable-minded people who have similar goals and rebuilding our state. And so this just seemed like common sense to me.
Is there any concern at all about out-of-state companies saying, We have a presence here in Michigan, maybe trying to get around this requirement by saying, hey, we've got a headquarters here in Pontiac, even though they might be based in London, or something along those lines, or any concern about there being accusations that, hey, this is, you're being biased against one to the other. Is that actually legal? Have you looked into those potential concerns?
Yes, so I've spent some time looking at that. We're having a lot of conversation. So the first thing that I want to say is Michigan has a national reputation as having one of the best procurement systems in the country. And I don't want to lose sight of that. We very much are focused on making sure we get the best possible value. I think it's possible to do both of these things, right? So we can make sure that tax dollars are spent very well, that it's done in a fair and transparent process. But what we're proposing is that if there's a space where a Michigan company has lost out on a bid, they get just a second chance to come back and offer a new proposal. But as far as I'm concerned, the definition really around what a Michigan-based company means is something we can have a conversation about. So if you have we do have companies that are headquartered in other parts of the country, other parts of the world, but if they are employing Michigan workers, if they are producing product right here in Michigan, if they have a substantial amount of their assets here in Michigan, to me that counts. What we actually are aiming for is when it's possible and when it makes sense in a value proposition that Michigan companies get a leg up.
And let's not make too much of it. The goal is, the concept is to support those who support our state, and our Michigan taxpayers would probably prefer to reinvest those dollars in Michigan than to send it to an out-of-state company. But we're not talking about revamping the entire bid process. This is just sort of an extra stab at it, where they get notification, hey, you're not the low bidder. Would you like to revisit your bid here? But the deal is this, is anytime you introduce a bill like this, as you know better than anybody, this is the beginning of a conversation. Our goal is very clear. We'd like to help Michigan businesses. But as you get into the details, I think both of us are perfectly willing to have discussions about what it means to be a Michigan business, what industries, is this across industries, are there tweaks we need to make here and there? The intent is clear, but this is why we go through the process here.
So just to clarify, the definition right now in the bill's earliest state would be a company that has Michigan operations, that has property in Michigan, and is hiring Michiganders.
Right. We think that that's a really good starting point. You know, the piece of it that I think is important as we are coming forward with a big idea proposal, deliberately, intentionally working across the aisle to make sure that we've got a bipartisan look at it, and then having the process of the conversation in the way our democracy is supposed to function, where we consider ideas, we bring a lot of people in to testify, a lot of people to have some ideas around how to make this better and get a better product at the end of the legislative process. But very willing to have, like Senator Moose said, very willing to have that conversation. It's important we have the conversation, but that is the core of it. Michigan workers, Michigan operations, Michigan production.
So if I'm like a California company, and I purchase land in Michigan, I open up a facility and I hire, let's say, 1,500 workers, and I've been there for 3 years. Could I now be identified as a Michigan company?
Well, again, those are the definitions we need to work on, but that's sort of what we're looking for. Yeah, set up shop in Michigan, and you might get a little leg up in getting Michigan contracts. I mean, this is a pretty simple concept. Other states do this, and the federal government has, I think, should be absolutely doing this if we want to be rebuilding manufacturing and these type of things in the country. We need to start to think about where we spend our money. So that would be something in my mind. That's great. That's preferable, what you described, that California company, than a company sitting in Texas who says, yeah, I'll bid on that. We'll send some people there, and then we'll bring them home right afterwards. So we have no long-term impact in the state. We're trying to build a viable economy here that is vibrant and diversified. And that is located here, and the money stays here. And however we get there, I hope we get a lot of great ideas along throughout this whole process here. But that's the goal.
Senator Rivett, it was important for you to reach out to Senator DeMoose and make him a part of this package. Why is that?
Well, I don't think it's a secret that a lot of our political systems are broken. I've been around for a while, in my 50s now. I have never seen a time that had such divisiveness. continuous attacks where we forget about the power of relationships. And I do think it's entirely possible to do good work and for our political process to be civil and benefit from diverse ideas. And when I was approached and with this idea and started working on it, the very first thing I did was say, let's find someone on the other side of the aisle that can walk along in this. So I don't believe that any one party cares about the economy more than the other party. I don't believe that any one party cares about the welfare of children more than the other party. So there's a way that we can that we can bring people together. I would love for there to be more opportunities where we're bringing folks from both sides of the aisle and running ideas down the middle, which is a, something that used to happen a lot more in Lansing. And we can get back at it. We just have to be intentional.
And Senator DeMoose, you didn't have any hesitation jumping on board this.
And I'll tell you what, it's what our people of our state are demanding. People are sick of this political environment right now. I'm sick of this political environment right now. And people need to recognize this is not a sport. And I've been astounded. So I've only been in the legislature a couple of years. I did one term in the House and I'm just getting started in the Senate. I'm astounded by how many times I hear comments about from both sides of the aisle, basically related to scoring points and making other people look bad. I mean, we have real work to do. We look at what's happening with our economy, with things like mental health, with all these other things that are real issues, affordable housing. And yet so many people are just sitting around playing games politically. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to do that. And the other thing is, it's just the right thing to do. I got criticized in my own district saying, DeMoose, we heard you're down there trying to make friends with Democrats. We didn't send you down there for that. We sent you down there to fight. And the first thing I pointed out to him, first of all, I'm a man of faith. And in scripture, it says we're to treat others as we would like to be treated. So this is a moral issue. Secondly, I go down there and yell at people, or Senator McDonnell Rivet comes and just yells at Republicans, the one thing she's guaranteeing, and the one thing I'm guaranteeing, is that we'll never listen to each other on this again, and we have no chance of persuading one another. So it's also the smart thing to do. It's the right thing and the smart thing to do.
Yeah, I could not agree with that more. I have to tell you. So, you know, I'm in the fourth, fifth month of my first term in partisan office. And, but, you know, we talked to thousands of people. I, you know, my campaign knocked on 75,000 doors. Not once did someone say to me, we're sending you down there to get as many retweets as you possibly can in a partisan issue. You know, I mean, it's just nonsense. And in my district, you know, I think that our districts, Senator DeMoose's district and I are very similar. We are practical people. At the end of the day, we care about making sure that we have good paying jobs that allow us to, you know, raise our kids. I always talk about this. Can people want to own a home, raise their kids, save for retirement, and occasionally go to Disney World? That's the priority. And right now in Michigan, right? I mean, that's the dream. That's the Michigan dream. You get to head to Florida in the summer times, in the winter times. But the 6 in 10 jobs in Michigan pay less than $47,000 a year. That's the priority. That's the problem. We have got to really work toward raising median income, getting more high paying jobs, and increasing our population. And I have had so many conversations with Senator DeMoose, who feels the same exact way. Now, we may disagree about what the exact path is to get there at every single moment, but we both agree that that's the North Star. So,
absolutely,
it's possible to do this without screaming at each other.
Last term, I had a bill in the House that was related to automobile rebates, and it was a two-bill package. I was working with. Well, ended up working with Joe Tate. I wanted it to be bipartisan. So I took it to one person from one Democratic representative, and she brought up a challenge. And I said, well, I don't know. Forget it. Then I went to another one, and they brought the same challenge up. And then I went to Joe Tate, and he said the same thing. I said, well, I better take this seriously if we want to actually do this. Well, you know what? His idea was great. He made my bill better. I hadn't even thought of what he was talking about. We added it in. And work together. So, I mean, there's good ideas where it requires a little humility and a little recognition that we're not in ourselves the fountain of all wisdom. There are thoughtful people out there who are smart people who have great experiences that we should listen to on both sides of the aisle.
what would each of you say, who or what is the source of the political saltiness right now in Lansing?
Like such a loaded question.
It is. But I mean, I'll say one thing. I do think in a way, I mean, it's really easy to blame all of the elected officials. And certainly a lot of people do contribute to this. But this is in a lot of ways a reflection of our society, too, which is being pitted against one another, whether it's because of sort of the news media or social media, or we've sort of collectively in a bad mood and angry in this culture these days. And I think what you're seeing is sort of a reflection of that. And it's wrong. I mean, to me, this is the biggest call of our day beyond any policies, is rebuilding a sense of grace and civility. Yes. And if we can do that, we can do a lot together.
I completely agree. And the other piece that I would say, I think there's all kinds of things you can point to that are sort of turning the temperature up. But at its core, particularly, you know, remembering that we're just coming out of this pandemic, there's a lot of fear. And it is an easy thing to do to turn that fear into hate and use it to score political points. And I see that present more and more in political dialogue. And that's the piece that it's also easy to just sort of sit in my living room and condemn it. But what really has to happen is a different behavior. And it's one of the things that I'm committed to while I'm serving, that to behave differently, to not use that space where, you know, and the fear is, you know, in some cases it's around the health, it's around the health situation from the pandemic, but it's also fear of not being able to afford next month's mortgage. It's fear of a job going away. It's fear of kids being safe at school. All of those things, it's just the base of how we're operating. And we have to, the only way out is to do something different. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
Well, that's very, very insightful commentary. Senator Kristen McDonald-Rivett and Senator John DeMoose, thank you so much for being on the podcast, talk about the legislation, the political environment. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Joining us now on the podcast is Mitch Zeller. He is the former director of the FDA Center for Tobacco Products and current Qnovia Advisory Board member. Thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Great to be with you. Thanks.
You are very passionate about what states are doing or not doing as it relates to smoking cessation and the money they get from the federal government to try and do something about getting people to quit smoking. Why don't you give our listeners a little background on your interest in the subject and what you're seeing?
Sure. I've been working on tobacco regulatory and cessation policy one way or another since 1994, during my first stint at the Food and Drug Administration, when the goal then was to simply assert jurisdiction and regulate tobacco products for the first time ever at the federal level. And I had two stints at FDA. I was in the private sector consulting on cessation programs and services domestically and globally. And you're right, the passion is there because honestly, with all the progress that we've made in reducing the consumption and prevalence of cigarettes in the United States compared to when I was a kid growing up in the 1960s, it's still the leading cause of completely preventable disease and death in the country and in the world. And so while we can be happy with the progress that's been made over the past half century, there's still a tremendous amount of work to do to confront what remains a huge public health problem.
And you're in particular interested about states. Do you feel that the states aren't doing enough? And if so, why?
Yeah, sadly, the states have fallen down on the job. In general, there are a couple of exceptions, and going back over time, you know, even more. A lot of this dates back to something called the Master Settlement Agreement. Folks may not remember, but back in the 1990s, every single state sued the tobacco industry for reimbursement for healthcare costs that the states were incurring to treat tobacco-related illness and disease. Every single state sued. 46 of the states, including the state of Michigan, collectively settled their lawsuits in something known as the Master Settlement Agreement in 1998, which provided that billions of dollars were going to flow to the states from that settlement. And while it wasn't mandated in that settlement that significant dollars be set aside for tobacco cessation and treatment, that was certainly the expectation of the people involved in the litigation. And sadly, Michigan and many other states have simply fallen down on the job. They take the money every year, but they're not making the investment that they need to be making to fund prevention and treatment programs and services.
Can you tell us what percent of the master settlement that comes to Michigan does get spent on prevention and treatment?
It's probably in the low single digits. I don't have a specific number, but it's probably in the low single digits. And again, I'm not saying that all of that money should be invested in tobacco prevention and cessation, but that was the reason why the lawsuits were brought in the first place. I can tell you that every year the Centers for Disease Control put out recommendations for what each state should be spending on prevention and cessation. And Michigan is only spending at a rate of about 4% of the recommended CDC levels for prevention and treatment.
So who actually benefits then if they're not creating these cessation programs?
Well, that money goes into state coffers. So it's revenue for the money, but I would argue that it is a missed public health opportunity. Talking specifically about Michigan, you have an incredibly high smoking rate in Michigan. The last numbers that I saw were for 2021. The national adult smoking rate was just a little over 11%. You have a smoking rate of around 17%, which is 54% higher than the national average. So there's a compelling public health reason for your state to be making more of an investment in prevention and cessation.
When you talk about this issue of, you know, needing more prevention programs, what state do you think is the perfect example and what program are they delivering?
For prevention, the leaders historically have been California, Massachusetts, and New York. I don't want to say that all three states, you know, every single year, year in and year out, have been making the right level of investment. But if we look back over time, those are the three states that are the leaders. If we look back further in time, ironically, given where politics is in the state of Florida, Florida at one point back in the late 1990s had been a leader in investment in youth prevention programs. And so programmatically, what that means is creative paid advertising to get the message out on the prevention side to kids about the harms of tobacco products. But on the treatment and cessation side for adults, there needs to be a massive investment in products, programs, and services, evidence-based products, programs, and services to help smokers quit. The overwhelming majority of smokers are concerned about their health, interested in quitting. Nationally, every single year, more than half of the smokers that remain say they intend to make a quit attempt. And of those that do, fewer than 6 or 7% succeed.
Those three states that you mentioned, they typically have exceedingly high taxes on smokers, cigarette tobacco products. Are you suggesting that that's one of the things that they do? And if so, is that actually, you know, deterring the state from doing these cessation programs?
The issue of taxation is a really important policy matter to put on the table when it comes to impact on tobacco use. The data shows that for every 10% increase in the price of a pack of cigarettes, consumption will go down by 7%. So if we're trying to increase the number of smokers who make a quit attempt, put aside the company that I'm now advising for treatment efforts, simply continuing to raise the price of a pack of cigarettes will have an effect on boosting quit attempts. Michigan has a pretty good cigarette tax rate. I think it's $2 a pack.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But that means that there's still about a third of the states that have a higher tax than Michigan. But $2 is not bad. But were your legislature to consider raising the tax on a pack of cigarettes even more, and then mandating that some or all of that increase be invested in cessation programs and services, that would be a great public health advance, given that you have an incredibly high smoking rate in your state.
Before we got on the call with you, I looked at the number, the tax dollar number that comes off our tobacco tax in the state of Michigan. I think we're expected to get $819 million. Is there a built-in financial incentive for the state just to do nothing, stand still?
I think that's more a question for your politicians and the advocacy community on the ground there. Hard for me to say, you know, sitting nationally. I would hope that the death and disease from cigarette use is not a partisan political issue. Liberals, conservatives, Democrats, Republicans, independents smoke and on average die 11 to 12 years sooner than someone who doesn't smoke. And so everyone has someone in their lives that has been affected by the harms of smoking. And so if I was a legislator in a state that had a smoking rate that was more than 50% higher than the national average at a time of historically low adult smoking rates in the United States, I would take a look at that 800 whatever million dollars and figure out how much of that should be set aside for an investment in evidence-based programs, both on the prevention side and on the treatment side, so that when we start to look at your smoking rates a year or two or three from now, you're not 54% higher than the national average.
You know, while having this conversation, I had to think, like, I can't, you know, it's been a hot minute since I've seen a, stay away from nicotine ad on my screen. But do you think there's an issue that us as a culture are starting to step away from the issue and are just starting to say, hey, we have bigger fish to fry. We've invested all that we could, and now it's time to move on. Is that something that you've noticed?
Yeah, sadly, I think that there are a lot of people who think problem solved. I don't want to diminish or devalue the progress that has been made over the last half century. It is wonderful that we have historically low adult and youth cigarette smoking rates, but the national number masks what's happening at the state level. You have a state with a very high smoking rate compared to the national level, and both at the national and the state level, whatever those percentages are, they are going to mask what is going on at a subpopulation level. So for example, if you look at it based upon educational attainment, we last had a national smoking rate of about 35% in the mid-1970s. So it's been almost 50 years since the national smoking rate was 34-35%. That's the smoking rate we have today nationally for those who only have a high school equivalency degree. So there are very important subpopulation groups, people with substance abuse and mental health comorbidities, who we have failed. That is the remaining smoker today. Someone with less education, lower income, a substance abuse or mental health problem. And again, I applaud the progress that has been made. But as I said earlier, it remains the leading cause of preventable disease and death. We, as a country, we spend hundreds of billions of dollars a year on the direct and indirect healthcare costs associated with smoking. And so it's time to sort of re-energize the debate and for politicians to double down on an investment in evidence-based products, programs, and services. When it comes to treatment, we're fighting this problem in the 21st century with really poor 20th century tools. So this little startup company that I'm advising is going through the process of trying to get an authorization from the Food and Drug Administration that would be truly innovative if they can prove what needs to be proven to the regulator, because it would involve the inhalation of a medicinal nicotine product. Currently, we have nicotine gum, nicotine patch, nicotine lozenge, and think about nicotine delivery if you're putting a patch on your arm or if you're putting a lozenge or gum in your mouth, and the speed with which the nicotine gets in that way for treatment purposes compared to, you know, inhaling on a cigarette. The cigarette is designed to get the nicotine into the brain in less than 10 seconds from each puff. The patch delivers the nicotine through the bloodstream in 60 to 90 minutes. So those smokers that we see out on the street, you know, in the cold and in the wind, smoking, they're smoking to stave off the symptoms of withdrawal. And they know that they're going to get a pretty quick hit from a puff of cigarette. Is it possible that there could be an FDA authorized pharmacotherapy, a drug for cessation purposes, that could come close to duplicating the speed with which a cigarette delivers the nicotine, but without having to inhale the 7,000 chemicals in smoke? So there are opportunities out there to, if the states are going to make the investment, I would love to see the states have access to more tools down the road for cessation.
Then why shouldn't the U.S. just then embrace vaping as a cessation technique? I mean, Great Britain has done it as far as their public health approach to cessation.
And I actually just looked up the statistics for vaping, and vaping in Michigan is lower than the rest of the United States. So that kind of, you know, makes up that extra portion of the tobacco users that would be in that cigarette area.
I think if we look at vaping, electronic cigarettes, all of these alternative and less harmful products, first through the lens of harm reduction, if a smoker completely switches to one of those products, completely switches, that's the key, there's no question that they would reduce their risk of disease. The key is complete switching. The reality with e-cigarettes is a significant portion of vapers continue to smoke cigarettes. So that raises a separate question of how much of a reduction, if any, is there in the number of cigarettes that they smoke per day or per week if they are now both smoking and vaping. And there's really interesting evidence that is emerging that, let's take the hypothetical pack-a-day smoker. If they have not completely switched to e-cigarettes, but they have significantly reduced the number of cigarettes per day, then we now have evidence to show that while it'd be better if they completely switched, if they've significantly reduced the number of cigarettes they smoke, then they are significantly reducing their exposure to toxins in cigarettes. The public health question that remains is, what about those so-called dual users that have not had a significant reduction in their cigarette smoke per day? And there the evidence is, then there's little to no reduction in exposure to toxins. But absolutely, if a smoker completely switches to e-cigarettes or other alternative and less harmful products, there is no question that they will be reducing their risk of illness and disease. And then there's a separate question for all of us, which is, and what if some of those people need to stay on those other products for a very long time, if not forever, to avoid lapsing and relapsing to the more harmful product? That's a question that that needs to be discussed. I happen to be of the opinion that if someone was able to completely switch to an e-cigarette and that's what's keeping them from ever going back to a cigarette, if there were talking about nicotine delivery without the all of the nasty chemicals in tobacco and tobacco smoke, and if there are people that need to stay on that product for a very long time, I don't have a problem with that. But that's a separate question that remains, you know, under discussion, you know, more broadly in the public health community, because there are some people who think that the ultimate end state, if you will, is both tobacco-free and nicotine-free. I think that for those who need to remain on a less harmful nicotine product for a very long time, they should have the ability to do that.
So as far as smoke goes, with tobacco, it seems like, especially within Michigan, there's a rise. While the tobacco users of cigarettes are going down, it does seem that there's a rise in the number of marijuana users and smokers as well. What are your thoughts as far as the that, you know, they there are just as many chemicals when burning, you know, marijuana. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's going to be, it'll take a very long time before we see the legalization of marijuana nationally. I think legalization will continue on a state by state basis. I think that even with legalization, I think that that there is public health risk associated with inhaling any burnt leaves directly into your lungs. The lungs were not designed to take that in, but I also understand that we're talking about, you know, a recreational drug for which, you know, one state after another has decided that it is lawful, and at least the retail operations are subject to some regulation. But obviously, there's risk with taking the load of any chemicals from any burnt leaf directly into your lungs.
Mitch Zeller, he is the former director of the FDA's Center for Tobacco Products and current Qnovia Advisory Board member. Thank you for being on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thank you all so much.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to all of our guests today, starting with Felix Sharp Caballero, and then moving on to State Senator John DeMoose and Kristen McDonald Rivett. Also, thanks to Mitch Zeller for joining us a little earlier today. I'd like to thank Mark Bayshore for the post-production of the MERS Monday podcast, and also AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. For the boss, John Roerink, Andrew Miniger, Samantha Schreiber, I am Kyle Malin. Until next week, take care. You need to calm down.